The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Colombia is back in the news. The Colombian Civil War officially began in 1964. Years of violence before then. You'd think after half a century of conflict that all sides would be eager to finally put down their arms. A peace accord was signed in 2016 between the Colombian government and the largest left-wing rebel group, the FARC. To learn more about how that peace is going, I have with me Sanjo Tree. Sanjo is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's been director of its drug policy project since 1998. A former military and diplomatic historian, his current work encompasses the reform of both international and domestic drug policies by promoting alternatives to the failed prohibitionist model. Sanjo Tree is also one of my best friends, and it is such a pleasure to be talking with you, brother.
Great to be with you, Doug.
So, Colombia. How's that peace accord going?
Boy, you know, you'd think after 50 years, the longest civil war in this hemisphere, the Colombians would have jumped with joy that they finally negotiated a peace treaty with the guerrillas. And some people were very ecstatic. But the agreement called for all kinds of things, aid to displaced people, to demobilized guerrillas, to the peasant farmers, to do all the things that, you know, many of the things that fueled the insurrection, the revolution to begin with, the injustices, the abandonment by the state. And there were many wonderful provisions in those peace treaties to begin to help farmers who have been historically abandoned by the state in these rural areas, which is why many of them grow coca. And instead of following through those commitments with the guerrillas, the right-wing Colombian president, President Duque, who's the current president, and the peace deal was negotiated by the former conservative president, who was actually a, you know, sensible guy who actually negotiated this. So this president, Duque, he is an ultra-right winger in much the, you know, mold of Trump or Bolsonaro in Brazil or Duterte in the Philippines, a tough guy. And he did not want to follow through with those peace terms with the guerrillas. He thought, well, you guys are terrorists. We need to punish you even more. We're never going to make it easy for you people. And so when you finally, you know, got your foe to lay down weapons and to cooperate, instead of accepting their surrender and helping them and making sure things go smoothly, they're sticking a finger in their eye. And as a result, it's the peasants, the farmers, who are getting out of any kind of assistance. And the guerrillas that laid down their weapons, many of them have been assassinated by right-wing death squads, are not being protected. And some are picking up arms again. Others are turning to the drug trade. Others are turning to criminal groups. You know, people are fed up. And it's becoming an extremely violent place once again. And so it's the old saying, you know, the only thing worse than organized crime is disorganized crime. And so when the FARC guerrillas controlled, you know, a third of the country in the rural areas, there was, whether you like them or not, and they could be quite brutal, a system of law and order, their law and order. And in that sense, they're a bit like the Taliban, different, very different politically, but in the sense that, yes, they were corrupt, but they were less corrupt than the government. And you could get a semblance of justice. If your neighbor stole your chickens or your pigs, you might get some justice. Now there is no justice. There's no rule of law. And you have all kinds of criminal groups and armed actors moving in to fill the vacuum that the FARC guerrillas used to fill, right? And so when the FARC were in control, you didn't mess around in their turf because they would mete out punishment. Now that they've laid down their weapons, anybody can go in there, steal that land, use it for cattle grazing, for coca growing, for gold mining, emerald mining, oil drilling, all kinds of natural resource grabs, land grabs. Very often we're talking about indigenous peoples who are getting their land stolen from them or peasant farmers. And so it's become a very violent place post-Civil War, which is very counterintuitive, but that's what's happening. And in this context, there's no one to stop farmers from growing as much coca as they want, or however they want to do it. And there are many, many groups now willing to pay them to do that. So that's what's happening. There are people, right-wingers, who say, oh, well, this just shows we have to go back to the old days of the drug war and do the aerial spraying again, which had been terminated in 2015 because the World Health Organization linked the chemical, the main ingredient being, you know, Roundup or glyphosate, linked it to cancer. And so the Colombian government had to stop using that chemical in aerial spraying. President Duque, however, says, no, no, we have to resume that. Even though it didn't work before. And the moment they stopped spraying, the coca returned because it was not a sustainable option. But here we are again. President Duque wants to do this. He's running up against environmental regulations at home. And just yesterday, we had a bit of good news in Congress, rare on Colombia issues, that AOC's filed two amendments. One of them was to withhold funds from the ESMA, the riot police in Colombia, which the Colombian police are organized under the military, not civilians, right? And the riot police are some of the worst. And so there have been riots all year long in Colombia, and they've killed dozens, scores of people, caught on film, just brutal, blatant killings. And this is done by the government. And so we had an amendment passed through the National Defense Authorization Act yesterday that would withhold funds to them. And the other amendment would withhold funds for aerial fumigation through DOD spending, provided until they meet their own domestic laws and environmental regulations. That's symbolically very important. However, most of the aerial spraying is done through State Department funding. So it's a different pot of money. So I'll tackle that when we get there. But politically, for the U.S. House of Representatives to stand up and say, to stand up against this kind of a pillar of the drug war in Latin America is a big deal. So that politically, it signals a lot here.
How do drug traffickers take advantage of the conflict?
So drugs and conflict are very much linked. When you have lawlessness and lack of state presence, lack of control, there's a vacuum there that can be exploited by all kinds of different groups, and very often insurgent groups, whether they're the left-wing guerrillas or the right-wing paramilitary death squads, they have to fund their wars, which are very expensive. Weapons are expensive. And so drugs are a very easy source of income. You can literally mint your own money. It's kind of like an ATM in the jungle. And there's just an enormous amount of ungoverned territories in which you can either grow the stuff or persuade peasant farmers to grow it for you and act as the middleman to sell to narco traffickers for a huge hefty markup. So that's how a lot of these groups finance themselves.
From Colombia over to the Philippines. Thousands of murders have been committed in the Philippines over the last few years by police and unofficial death squads in the name of a phony war on drugs. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has ignored protests of human rights activists around the world. The International Criminal Court's preliminary investigation concluded earlier this year. The ICC is now opening an official investigation. Do you think we're going to see Duterte in the dock at The Hague anytime soon?
These things take time, unfortunately. And he's trying to run out the clock as best he can, but he's also perhaps going to try to stay in office longer than anticipated. And so his term of office is up next year, but there he may run as vice president and hope to stay ahead of any kind of international or domestic prosecutors that way. Remind you of someone you know in this country. It's an old playbook in that sense, how to stay one step ahead of prosecutors. But President Duterte is doubling down on his drug war. He is, you know, not changed his rhetoric, has not apologized one bit, and vows to do more of the same. Now, Senator Manny Pacquiao, the famous boxer, is also thinking of throwing his hat into the ring at the run for president as well. And he is extremely reactionary and right wing, right? This is, you know, a boxer who thinks he can coerce people into doing things. And he supported Duterte's drug war and death squads, you know, fully for many years. This past year, he's had a falling out with Duterte. So they're kind of in conflict with each other. But he's still a very right wing figure. And unfortunately, you know, it's that kind of right-wing populism, if you will, the authoritarian, simple-minded solutions to very complex problems does carry some traction with people who don't have a lot of time to think about, you know, how counterintuitive solutions really are and how they work. And so what's changed is that 4 years ago, I would have said, we're living in two worlds in terms of drug policy, right? You have certain countries that are ratcheting up the drug war and other countries that are you know, changing course. But I think those two worlds now are the same world in the sense that in countries that have liberalized drug policies, you also see this blinding white rage politics boiling under the surface, right? So it's not just a bipolar world with the U.S. and Russians and Chinese and Saudis and others on different sides of that drug war fence. That fence is also internalized. And the right-wing groups around the world are learning how to exploit these fissures and offer simple, knee-jerk, often very violent, repressive solutions to very complex problems. So that war that had been international is now being fought domestically as well. And so, yes, we are making tremendous progress in many ways in the official policy front. But on the other hand, the visceral way that the right wing does politics is bringing a lot of that brutality home. And I think it could get much uglier. We've been living in the past 4 years through this cultural fugue state where people are organized and mobilized along lines of rage rather than reason or philosophy. If you hate the same things I hate, then I agree with you on all kinds of things, right? That the people who are anti-mask are also coincidentally very pro-hydroxychloroquine and pro, you know, ivermectin, horse paste, and pro. It's a basket of issues. It's no longer issue by issue. It's tribal politics now. And I fear this could carry over into the drug and criminal justice space as well. So we're in for a bit of a showdown, very possibly. So yes, we are making progress, but we should not be complacent by any means. The opposition is mobilizing, and they're coming back with violence and vengeance.
This is a conversation with Sanho Trees, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Now, the Scottish government has grown tired of waiting for the UK government to act, and so they will now allow police to issue warnings for possession of Class A drugs rather than making an arrest and taking people into custody. Class A is the highest drug offense level in the UK, so that means cocaine, heroin, speed. They're not calling it decriminalization. I mean, that would take an act by the UK Parliament, you know, rose by any other name, etc. Similarly, cities across Canada have grown tired of waiting for the federal and provincial governments to act, and so they're attempting to decriminalize simple possession. Cities like Vancouver, Saskatoon. Similarly, activists in British Columbia have grown tired of waiting for governments to act, so they're working to provide a safe supply of drugs for people who use them. Safe supply, tested, known quality, known potency, no contaminants. Now, similarly, the state of Rhode Island has grown tired of waiting for our federal government to act, so they've passed a law to allow the establishment of harm reduction centers, you know, safe consumption sites at which trained staff can be available to act in case of an overdose. Now, that one's significant because, of course, in the previous administration, the Justice Department sued to stop the nonprofit organization Safe House in Philadelphia from opening a similar safe consumption site. The governor of Rhode Island signed that legislation a couple of months ago, and the Justice Department has not said a word, nor has ONDCP. In short, drug war's over, the drugs won. Prohibitionists have yet to capitulate. How much longer do you think this farce is going to go before it finally ends?
It's a good question. I think the lockdown has given us, in some ways, a new breath of life, in the sense that people have more time on their hands, they're more online. They have time to listen to podcasts and learn about things that are happening in different parts of the country or the different parts of the world, podcasts like yours, and say, you know, we should be doing that. Or, hey, that's a great idea. And they have time to communicate, to dash off a note to their representatives and stuff. And perhaps they, in ways they didn't have time to do before the lockdown, because they're too busy doing other things. The lockdown has also, you know, increased overdose deaths and made it much more of an urgent issue. And it gives people time to think about, okay, what do we really value? We value life, number one. And so the Canadians have done wonderfully in terms of safe supply, and say, if you really do care about life, then let's talk about safe supply, because nobody needs to die from this. And it becomes very clear that the only thing that's kept the opposition dominant all these years is that they're afraid of appearing to send the wrong message. It's about appearances, not about outcomes. And we can't afford appearances, because appearances kill people. If you don't have a concrete policy that actually works. And so I think safe supply is one of the better things to have come out of recent developments in drug policy. But we see similar things, you know, as you say, in Rhode Island and other places, people are mobilizing. It's going to be hard to undo that, hard to go back from that. Not that the opposition won't try, but we're more organized, more disciplined, more coherent in our messaging. And they're going to have to try to neutralize those things very deliberately. They can't just use fear tactics anymore, because we've got actual arguments out there that counter theirs. And people are willing to listen. And we're messaging it much better now.
How do we keep pressure on this administration and on the Congress to make these changes happen? I mean, obviously, they're getting pushback. In every reform, there's pushback. What can we do to keep the pressure on? How can we nail their pants to the damn mast?
It's about persistence and the care and feeding of elected officials, and it's something we don't teach in this country, not in schools. Although we should. We brag about our democracy so much and how we're going to export it to other countries, whether they want it or not, and yet we don't teach our own people how to take advantage of the democracy that we have. And so that I was never taught in school how to lobby, how to talk to my elected representatives, other than to write a letter if I'm upset about something. But in fact, there's a whole toolbox of techniques to put pressure on your elected officials. And I say your elected officials, not someone else's elected officials, right? Because you have leverage over your senator, your representatives, but not someone else's, because you don't vote for them. You can't vote for them. And so educating people about how to create that illusion of the marching millions, because that's what representative democracy is about. It's not about each of us going to the polls every time to give an up or down plebiscite on every issue. We elect people to do it for us. And they have to figure out, well, what do their constituents really believe? And if you don't communicate that to them, then the people who do speak up are the ones who will get heard. And you can always count on the sheriffs and the DARE people and the CADCA people to get their people out there to communicate to the representatives. And that's what they hear. So if they don't hear from reformers and from people like us on our side, they think, well, the consensus is in the other direction. And it may not be. But that's not necessarily their fault, because no member of Congress can afford to poll their constituents every time there's a vote to be had. It gets ridiculously expensive that way, right? And so it does require some responsibility on the part of the citizenry to communicate to their representatives. And I think we're seeing this more and more on every level. There's a civil war happening right now. And it's happening in our school board level primarily, where it's really getting nasty and heated, because the anti-mask, the anti-vaxxers, and the right wing that, you know, that supports that whole spectrum of those Trumpy issues are telling their people to go to local school board meetings and have a fit. And that's what they're doing. They're having tantrums and throwing rage fests and threatening school board members. School board members are quitting around the country because they're getting threats, death threats. They're getting doxxed. Their addresses are being published. And so if we don't participate in democracy, if we don't exercise this right that we have, other people will do that. And the ones who are organizing are very scary people. They're extremely ignorant and would only accelerate the pandemic exponentially if they ever got their way. And so the real patriots today are the people who I think are running for local school board, who may not even have kids, who said, you know, this is, the fight is on our streets now. It's in our neighborhoods. It's in our counties. And if we don't start taking positions, we're going to get steamrolled. This is what the right has been doing for decades, by the way. Right, going back to the Reagan Revolution, they said, "Go start with your school boards, go for town councils, go for that type low hanging fruit. We'll see who gets elected. We'll see who has the talent. Then we'll invest in those people. We'll groom them for higher office, and that's how they get their have a deep bench for higher office because they test marketed a lot of their talent already." We're very far behind the curve in that sense, but people are starting to mobilize. And to me, those are my real heroes today. Thank them for their service.
Coming to the end of the show, again, my guest has been Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project. In the previous administration, internationally at least, it feels like we stepped back somewhat. And aside from talking about the weed business, our folks didn't really do that much over in the during the UN meetings. Do you think it's going to change at all with this administration?
Yeah, I think there'll be more international engagement. Whether they'll allow us to re-enter is another question, because we behaved so badly in the past 4 years. But under the previous guy. No, there was no interest in international multilateral organizations and working cooperatively or building consensus or any of that. It was all strictly of what's in it for him and what can he gain to his advantage. Where can he build some hotels or suck up to some autocrat? But other than that, he had no intellectual curiosity, no philosophical conviction, no ideology that would involve any kind of international cooperation or agreements or consensus. But Biden is trying to return things back to normal, and normal wasn't always great. let's be clear about that. But it's better to talk and engage than not in most cases.
We're not going to see Biden Biden giving an endorsement to, for instance, Rodrigo Duterte.
No. No. Biden, I think, is interesting in the sense that he's, yes, there's a lot of disappointments, right? The way Afghanistan was handled, et cetera.
The current crisis at the Mexican border with the Haitian.
On the other hand, I followed Biden since the late 80s, when he first ran for president. And he was, for the longest time, a stuffed shirt, pompous, arrogant, drug war mongering, centrist who was not very thoughtful and was almost ineducable. I once briefed him on the drug war. I had 10 minutes with him. He talked for 9.5 minutes and I was able to get in, 30 seconds, maybe a minute. But nowadays, this is a different Biden. He listens to people more, maybe because he's slowing down, maybe because he's losing a little bit of his faculties, but he's listening more. That could be a sign of maturity because people do become wiser as they grow older. And I know it's hard to convince young people of that, and it's something I had to learn the hard way, but occasionally it happens, right? Not everyone turns right-wing and reactionary and batty like the former guy. And some people actually do listen and learn. And I find that he is willing to listen to experts more because he has to come up with solutions. And I think, and this is me psychobabble, analyzing him from afar, but I think he's thinking in terms of legacy, that he has, accumulated all his political capital over so many decades. For what purpose? At some point, he's got to spend it. And this is he's got at a point in his life where he needs to start spending it now. And I think that gives him permission and room and will to think about legacy issues and how to change things for the better and be remembered for that. I don't think this is the same Joe Biden that was operating 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So in that sense, I'm optimistic about Biden. I think he's showing a more thoughtful side to him, and maybe it's just he's preoccupied with other things and can't screw things up that badly, but I do get the sense he's listening a bit more to experts. Maybe not ONDCB, maybe not his bureaucrats and all the different fiefdoms that are defending their turf and their interests and stuff. It's something to watch out for in Biden in terms of how that's changed with him.
I think you got it. I think you're right about when you said the legacy, thinking about a legacy. I mean, the last guy's legacy was never. I don't think he ever had a vision of anything beyond a gaudy casino and a gold plated toilet
and big golden statues of himself. That's about it.
Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. Right, and you're right. And maybe you're right. I mean, if Biden does start thinking about his legacy, his policy legacy, then you got to start thinking about what this stuff actually means, not just how big will the headline be tomorrow, but what will the history books say?
When you factor his age and the fact that he's probably, in all reality, a one-term president. Too old to run again, I hope, although it's not convincing Chuck Grassley. In reality, he is getting older. And so if this is his last term, then yeah, I think legacy becomes a really serious issue. And I think that's where he wants to look good in history. Not CYA to earn some political capital for next year's fight. It's more about this is his last shot.
Let's see. Give us your social media website and all that so people can keep up with what you do.
Best way to follow me is on Twitter. I'm at Sanho Tree. And my office website is ips-dc.org.
That was my conversation with Sanho Tree. He's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of its Drug Policy Project. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for the Drug Truth Network and is distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. Please support your local community and public radio stations. Become a member today. You can find this edition of Century of Lies, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. There's a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.